Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So have we got a treat for you today? Tony, welcome to the show. When we had that conversation last month, you really touched me in the heart and the soul. I felt like I found a new friend, and I'm sure that the listeners are going to love what you have to share today.
Thank you so much, Simon. I greatly enjoyed the insight that you provided last time you spoke as well, my friend. And I look forward to this podcast, and I also really just appreciate being able to be a part of what you're doing here. So thank you for having me.
That's great. That's great. So can you introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
Yeah. So my name is Tony Hines. I am an interracial adoptee. I was adopted from Washington, D.C. in the mid-90s, and I grew up here in the United States in and around the Washington, D.C. and Maryland area. And I also have queer parents too. Both of my moms growing up are white, and they're also lesbian moms too.
Wow. Okay. So there's a lot to unpack there. So listeners, we're going to look at this from both perspectives. So the perspectives of adoptive parents who perhaps are struggling with their transracial adopted kids. And also we're going to look at it from maybe adult adoptees who are still struggling, because as a white guy adopted by white parents, I have no perspective. I have no take on this whatsoever. And clearly Tony has that. And that's what we're going to bring out, because this podcast is all about the perspectives of the guests. And I try to sprinkle in a little bit of my perspective where it's appropriate, but really today is going to be all about what Tony's lived experience and what he's doing now. And you're doing some research as well, I remember from when we discussed last time.
Yes, I am, Simon. So I am doing my PhD research on the topic of interracial adoption, and specifically on the social connectedness of adult Black interracial adoptees, which has been a really good experience. It's definitely taught me even more about not only the population that I'm interested in, but interracial adoption and adoption as a whole historically.
Yeah. So what do you mean by social connectedness?
So that's a great question. And so when we're thinking about social connectedness, we're envisioning how an individual is forming their sense of belongingness to the people that they're interacting with on a day-to-day basis. We're also thinking about how they're forming a sense of belonging to the communities in which they belong to. And so it's this really sense of connectedness and social connectedness that a lot of times can inform their overall well-being. And so by studying the social connectedness patterns of adult Black interracial adoptees, I hope to really glean what social connectedness can potentially mean for the well-being of this particular population of adoptees.
Yeah. And why did you choose that topic for your PhD?
Well, you know, they say that a lot of times PhD research mirrors your personal experience. And for me, this is a passion for me because it is part of my personal experience. I am an adult Black interracial adoptee myself. And so I really wanted to tap into that part of myself. I did my master's thesis on the psychological well-being of children within the same-sex-headed household, which again for me was something else that spoke to my personal experience. And so in doing my PhD, I wanted to really dive deeper into the interracial adoption piece of my experience. And so that's been interesting and exciting for me. And it also comes at a time where people seem to be talking more and more about interracial, or as a lot of people term it, transracial adoption. So I definitely feel that this will add to people's understanding of adoptees, not only as they exist from childhood until they're 18, but how we're faring as adults and the common challenges that we often face as adults in this world.
Yeah. And wow, I mean, what a curious guy, you know, like we're coming at this, you, you, you're researching an area here that is really, you know, like when I think about research, you know, I think about really scientific and labs and really left brain stuff here. But what you're looking at is the research into the real right brain and the heart based stuff, you know, like how we're feeling, how we are, how we're connecting, as you say, with our network and you know, our family, our network and our communities. So I think this is stunning stuff. Can I ask you why the topic of social connectedness?
Well, that's a good question too. You know, I thought about that for a while, and I really feel that social connectedness was a really good way to tap into the different experiences of adult Black interracial adoptees, because the concept of social connectedness allows the adoptee or the individual in general to frame how their experiences throughout their entire life course are informing in present times in their lives, their sense of belongingness, their sense of closeness, their sense of purpose, even as it relates to the interactions that they're having, as it relates to how they feel during those interactions, after those interactions, how they feel in regard to how they're experiencing their relationships in life. So social connectedness, for example, I could talk about my relationship to my parents as an adult adoptee, and I can express these experiences with my parents. Talking about race or not talking about race made me feel closer or not as close to them. I can talk about my peer groups and how conversations with them about being an adoptee and then not understanding what that meant exactly, how that felt isolating, how that made me feel that I didn't belong to my peer group, even though I was friends with members of my peer group. In my interactions just with strangers in society, when they're coming up to me and they find out about aspects of my story and they're asking me questions, that can be an exciting experience to talk about my story, but it can also be another experience that reminds me of my difference from the rest of my, quote, social world in that way. So all of these experiences kind of combined together are informing individuals' sense of social connectedness in the world that they belong to, and are informing also oftentimes their self-esteem, other aspects of their mental health, and sometimes their well-being too. Because if I feel disconnected from the world in which I exist, then that's going to have negative consequences on my mental health in a lot of cases. And that's not only in relation to adoption, but just in general for the individual who doesn't necessarily feel connected to the places that they're inhabiting. So I wanted to talk about that in my research, and I wanted to talk about it as it relates to adult Black interracial adoptees, because I feel it's important to study interracial adoption and interracial adoptees, period. But sometimes we often throw interracial adoptees into just one box, and we say these are the experiences of interracial adoptees, without fully understanding that even within those experiences, as it relates to different racial groups contained within that population, the population of interracial adoptees, I have unique experiences as a Black interracial adoptee in comparison to some of my friends who are Asian interracial adoptees, who are Latino interracial adoptees. You know, we all have some similar underlying experiences, but within our experiences, there's difference there too. And I wanted really to give power to that in talking about Black interracial adoptees. And I hope, and there's already research on Native American interracial adoptees, and I hope that my research inspires other interracial adoptees and people doing this research to zero in on specific populations of interracial adoptees too.
Wow. So what strikes me is that you've got all these different experiences, but essentially we all want the same, don't we? We all want to feel connected and loved and one is it, that's what we're all seeking, isn't it?
Yes. No, we all are seeking to be loved. And as it relates to adoption, the question is, how does that love look? What does it look like in practice? We know now from adoption practice in general that the love is enough approach isn't successful when it comes to adoptees, and also isn't successful when it comes to interracial adoptees. Having families love us is great, and we cherish that. But we need more than just love to be people who feel empowered. We need more than just love to feel comfortable in our own skin. And so when we talk about adoption and when we talk about interracial adoption, we add honoring birth family, right, to part of that way to love the child. When it comes to the interracial adoptee, we talk about how having representations of that child's cultural group in and around the household is important. Having books and having mentors for that child who are from the same cultural and racial groups as that child, how that's important, how that's another way to love our child. So we all want to be loved. And it's really important, though, to talk to parents and to reinforce for adoptees that it's okay to ask and to learn that there are different ways of loving oneself and for loving a member of your family. And for us, these ways of loving us have shown to be very impactful, have shown to be very beneficial when put into practice in the right ways.
Yeah. So the kind of the way I see it is that kind of love is the foundation, and the foundation on all on the fact that all this other stuff is kind of built on top. And I can't help wondering the things that you said. So honoring the birth family, representation of the culture, and mentors. And presumably you mean mentors with the same racial background as the adopted child, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. First of all, are there any other things that you kind of see as essential? An essential part of this cake?
Yes. One is that, you know, a lot of adoptees have this idea that we should be grateful for our adoptive families and that we would have had terrible, awful lives if we were not raised by our adoptive families. And for a lot of adoptees, that becomes kind of this weight, this anchor pulling them down, because it forces them to push down any feelings of uncomfortability that they have in and around their adoption, because sometimes we justify it and we say, well, maybe that part of my adoptive experience doesn't feel so great, but I just need to be grateful. It's okay to, again, love and cherish your parents, and that's related to adoptees and people who aren't adopted. But doing away from the grateful narrative as it relates to adoption is very important for adoptive families to be able to do. Because when we're able to do away with that narrative, what happens is we begin to see adoption for what it is. It's not a positive process. It's not a net positive process. It isn't a negative process in society. It's a complicated process. It's a complicated existence as an adoptee, and it's a nuanced existence that has, you know, great, great heights, great times with our families, that also, though, begins with the separation from our birth families, too, that needs to be acknowledged. And so it's really essential, and it ties back to that honoring the birth family piece.
Yeah.
To talk to parents about, you know, hey, it's okay to bring up with your kids that they may feel sad sometimes around not knowing members of their birth family, or to say to them, hey, I was thinking of your birth mom today. I know that she was a really good artist, and I see that in you as well. I know that it must be painful to not have your siblings around for situations where siblings aren't around. You know, none of these things are things that an individual, right, would feel grateful for, but we're told in society that adoptees should feel grateful and that parents should feel savior-esque for taking on that particular mantle, that role as parents, when in most cases they're making the conscious choice to become parents. And as important as it is to be good parents, for non-adoptive families, we don't call them saviors, we call them parents, and we call them good parents when they're good parents. And the same thing needs to be happening in adoptive households. And there's much more essential things, honestly, Simon, but I'll keep it brief from there. As it relates to interracial adoption, there's a lot more essential stuff there too.
Were you told that you should be grateful?
No, I was never told, thankfully, that I should be grateful to be adopted. I wasn't told that by my moms. They never said that growing up. What I was told, though, Simon, is that I should feel thankful to my moms for adopting me, and that they were serving a purpose in my life and in a certain way. And I was told that by someone who was prejudiced against gay people and felt that, you know, it's great that they adopted you, Tony, but you have to realize that your moms are going to hell and that their only purpose basically in your life is to get you where you need to go. And
wow,
was inferring there that if they hadn't raised me, that I would have had a worse life in some way. And at the same time was saying that they were sinful people who were going to hell too. So these things are, even when we're talking about adoption, some of this grateful narrative can get intertwined with other prejudices that people have from time to time too. And I saw that sometimes in my experience.
Yeah. I've got a slight concern about, well, first off, I being told that we should feel anyway different to the way that we feel is in my opinion is out of order. Yeah. So we feel how we feel, and you know, being told that we should feel somewhere differently in any sense for anybody, don't feel like that is kind of well, it's the opposite of empathy. Antipathy, is it? Antipathy. It's like, you know, you're heading for a deterioration in the relationship with that thing. So I don't think anybody should go around and telling other people how they should feel. And at the same time, I think that waiting for people to change how they think about us is really, really disempowering. So I saw a video of some adoptees who were, sorry, they, so people were in, there were some people interviewed, and they shared the about adoption, and the adoptees were shown their work, what the people said, and the adoptees were very concerned about what the other people think. And as I saw that, I thought that is really, really disempowering if we're waiting for the world to change their opinion of us before we can feel good. Then we're going to be waiting an awful long time. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, Simon. And that's why it's important for adoptees to find the tools to empower ourselves, because we are dealing in a world that sometimes is not going to treat us very well. And to your point, we shouldn't be waiting for society to change for those that aspire to. We should be trying to change society. And for those that would just like to live, you know, good, happy lives, we should be existing in ways that see us, again, finding ways to have a sense of positive self, to have good self-esteem. So when those instances do happen, when someone dismisses our experience as happy or go-lucky, this unicorn approach to unicorns and rainbows approach to adoption, that we then understand that that's not the case, but also that it doesn't make us feel somehow lesser of a being, that it doesn't make us feel like second-class citizens as it relates to how our family was formed versus how someone else's family was formed. And having pride in being all of who we are is very important for all of us.
Yeah. So I totally agree with all that. I'm not sure how to, well, I might be on slightly dodgy ground here. You know, I think we change the world from the inside out. So we, you know, when it comes to things like laws and things that are those things that we have to campaign for changes in these areas. You know, I'm thinking about any sort of prejudice, discrimination. That's what I'm thinking of. But in terms of campaigning for people to feel differently about us, or being disempowered, being bothered about what somebody else thinks about us. Somebody said this, and this wasn't related to adoption, or it wasn't even related, and it wasn't related to any sort of race issue. And that's why I feel I'm on slightly dodgy ground. So if I'm being insensitive here, Tony, just tell me. You know me. Hopefully you know me well enough that I don't mean to cause any offense. But, you know, if I'm straying into what is, you know, white privilege or something, right, just tell me and I'll move on. I'm just exploring this. But I heard something like other people's opinion of us is not our business. Something like that. I don't know who said that. But can you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, you know, and I'd like to also reframe something you said there.
Sure.
You brought up white privilege, and white privilege is a really hot topic to talk about. I would like to say that I actually find, and I know I'm in the minority here, but I think that we should find another phrase to use besides white privilege. I don't know what the phrase is. I just think that it's time to find another phrase, because even within this allocation of privilege that we're thinking of, when you think about privilege, well, what does it mean? Well, it usually means being granted something that other people are not granted in a way that is privileging you as some higher entity or member group or things like that. When I think about what it means to walk into the CVS here and to not be followed around the store, or to be followed around the store, if I'm not followed around the store, I don't feel that that's some privilege that is happening in my life. But when a white person in the United States, or perhaps in the UK too, is stopped by a police officer, and the police officer treats them nicely, is respectful, when that happens in the United States, a lot of people here would say that that's white privilege operating, that that officer is treating this individual nicely because they're white. They're not treating you nicely, Tony, because you're black or because you're brown. That means you don't have privilege. Well, it's not a privilege to be treated the right way. It's just something that we should do. We should just be treating others the way that we want to be treated. And if I'm treated nicely, that's not something that I feel, that is the lowest bar that we should be setting for human interaction. And I think sometimes what also happens is when you're told you have privilege, sometimes you internalize that and you think that, well, I'm not saying I'm better than anyone, but society sees me that way. So maybe I am, or maybe I'm on a higher plane. Sometimes it actually backfires. I've seen it. It reinforces notions of superiority in different groups of people. And that's not to say that certain people aren't benefiting from a system and systems that have been set up to marginalize certain populations at times and uplift other populations. I'm not saying that those benefits don't exist. I'm specifically talking about the phrase and what it does and what I've seen it do in practice. And so when I think about, you know, when I talk to parents, when I talk to interracial adoptive parents, I don't tell them to talk about white privilege with their kids. I tell them to talk about history. I tell them to educate their children on the pride that their children should have in their racial groups and the positive things that their racial groups have accomplished. If we're thinking about this collectivist notion of what it means to belong to an ethnic group, to a racial group. But I also talk to them about, you know, it's important to educate your kids about historically what has sometimes happened to different groups of people and how different groups of people have been marginalized and how those things, how people have fought against those things throughout society, throughout the history of society, how we combat those things if we are faced with discrimination, if we are faced with hearing racist things, and how us as white parents can educate other white parents who are not parents of adoptees or just who are not parents at all about ways that they can combat racism and homophobia and prejudice in their own neighborhoods too. And so I think, you know, when we're thinking about these things, that's what ties into this, you know, nuance, because sometimes when parents, especially white parents, hear that they're privileged, they think that they're privileged over their children, and that there's some, it kind of reinforces a level of difference in the household. It reinforces the notion that their children are the ones that need to be focusing on race, that they as parents need to be the ones that are making sure to provide these tools for their kids to feel comfortable as Black individuals, which is very important, but it de-incentivizes them sometimes to learn about their own cultural histories, to learn about the marginalization sometimes of their own group through history. Italian Americans would be a good example of that. Italian Americans were marginalized when they came to the United States. They were not enslaved, and these ways of marginalization are different. But it's important to talk and learn about these things so a child doesn't feel like they're isolated and that they're the only ones that are required to learn about their race within the home structure.
Yeah. Wow, there's a lot there. And you know, I don't feel like I've got a lot of knowledge in that area, in this area. You know, what I was, I took the word white privilege to mean discrimination, you know, like, I had a discussion with another transracial adoptee, and she mentioned it. I ventured a subject on something, and she said, "Oh, that's white privilege." And I took that as a criticism of myself, and I saw it as, you know, what some people might call unconscious bias, because I would never, you know, see myself that way. I was unconscious to the bias that I was communicating to her. She detected some bias that I was unconscious to. So that's why I try to be highly sensitive around this area.
Right.
So if we go back to the more practical side, or the key messages that you would want white parents of black kids, or, you know, parents who have been through a transracial adoption, what are the key messages that you'd like to share with them to help their adopted kids thrive?
One thing is that you need to begin to feel comfortable and uncomfortability. And what I mean by that is you need to look within yourselves, put yourself in situations that you might not have experienced before for the betterment of your child or your children. One good example is going to, for instance, if you're religious, going to an all-black church, if your child is black. You may not be used to being around in a segregated sense, black people, and you being the only white person in the room. People of color are very used to, a lot of times, to being in rooms where they're the only person of color in rooms. So that type of experience is something that you need to embrace in order for your child to be in community with people who look like them. And it also creates opportunities for you to be educated by friends that you're making within those communities, hopefully, when you do go to the church or another social gathering in that way. So that's one thing. Another thing that I would tell
Can I butt in that? An idea that, so that I'm always interested in the why, is, you know, most people focus on the how. But also the why that I'm thinking about. So as you said it, you know, you want to be ready to be, you know, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. So I was thinking, you know, just on a purely selfish basis, that's what I'm doing now. Like, so I was accused of this, white privilege or unconscious bias, you know. I felt really uncomfortable in that moment, but I am bringing it up here now to kind of bring it out to the air so that we can discuss it. And it is slightly uncomfortable, but I go there. And we had Isaac, yeah, do you know Isaac?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So we had Isaac, and he said that, you know, he felt that that parents should be doing more to, they don't, you know, doing more to prepare adopted kids, transracial adopted kids, for a world that sees color. So if I was a white adopted parent and I went to an all black church, it would give me a sense of how it felt to be in the minority. So I would get a sense of, I would be getting a sense for how my child might sometimes feel. And that kind of lived experience as me going to a black church or a black civic organization would allow me to, may feel uncomfortable initially, but it would allow me to understand my child's lack of comfort. Does that
make definitely sense? Definitely. I love what you said, and I also love what Isaac said too about preparing your child for a world that does see color. Yeah. And for us, that really means that we're thinking about what it means to understand that there are going to be people in this world who are going to treat you differently sometimes simply because the color of your skin. And to understand for children that being individuals who are going to know what that world looks like is going to be something that's going to help them build those tools. So when they do face those interactions, hopefully they'll be more prepared for it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all about that preparation, isn't it? So are there other key elements that you feel form part of that?
Yes, you know, there are, and you're talking about interracial adoption, correct? In relation to those other key elements. Another key element is really about examining, as I was saying, your own cultural histories as parents and understanding that you can surround your kids with people who look like them, and that is important. And you can watch movies and television shows of people who look like them, but that doesn't mean that their experiences as interracial adoptees are going to be the same experiences as the people they're watching on television or your neighbors down the street who have Black kids, who have Korean children. Our experiences as interracial adoptees are different from the experiences of members of our same race, non-adopted peers. We exist, yes, I exist as Tony, as a Black man, as a Black individual, but I also have had this kind of bicultural upbringing, in a sense, from being raised in a household where one of my adoptive moms is Irish, and my other adoptive mom has Polish ancestry. We didn't really talk much about Polish ancestry in the home, but we did talk a bit about my mother Mary's Irish ancestry in the home. And, you know, we did talk about what it was like for her growing up in a particular region, a region that didn't have that many Black people in it. And the same thing is true of my other mom. And so my experiences, my knowledge base was different in some ways than my peers' knowledge base was. They had a knowledge base that was informed from their parents who were growing up in different places, who were listening to different types of music than my parents, for instance, were listening to. And this concept of mixed race identities is really important to think about. A lot of adoptees are mixed race themselves, but even for those adoptees who are not mixed race, we kind of think sometimes in the same sense about, we have these same inclinations that a lot of mixed race people do about not feeling authentically, not feeling that we belong authentically to any racial group sometimes, especially growing up. Growing up, we feel that we're not authentically, quote, you know, Black enough. We're not Asian enough. And we know that we're not white. We know that we're not white because of the discrimination that you talk about. We know that we're not white because, as Isaac was saying, we're interacting with the world that does see color and reminds us of our difference. But like me, we sometimes don't have those same cultural experiences that our same race peers did. So we find ourselves a lot of times in the space in between. And so I tell parents that it's really important, one, to make sure that if you do have interracially adopted children, that you're finding other communities of interracial adoptees, of interracial adoptees, of families for them to interact with, to share in that unique difference, to share in that experience. And that it's also really important to talk about race in the home for those reasons, and to let your child know that it's okay sometimes to not feel as though they have it all down, and that there's no one way to be any race of people. And that by introducing them to these role models, to these mentors, to the movies in the television shows, in the books, that they're not saying that they need to be exactly like this black person in order to be considered black, in order to be considered another race. But at the same time, empowering them about what it means to know about some figures in their racial groups. It's a conversation that sometimes I feel is lacking a bit when we talk about interracial adoption. Most of the conversation tends to be about, let's surround our children with people who look like them and they'll be fine. But I'm here to tell you that interracial adoptees sometimes feel shunned by those communities, in addition to feeling shunned by white people. And so being able to kind of navigate both of those spaces to be, I heard one adoptee, interracial adoptee, said that we're chameleons. And I think that, I'm not sure that's an apropos term, because I don't want to infer that we're just changing based upon every group that we're interacting with. But I do think that there's something to be said for being able to feel like ourselves, and to feel confident in ourselves, no matter what racial group we're interacting with, and to know that if any person, white, brown, black, has an issue with us as it relates to our culture, our race, then that's a them problem. It's not an us problem when we have done that that particular work on ourselves to be comfortable and, again, all of who we are.
Wow. Wow, you speak so eloquently and clearly on this, Tony. I mean, it's normally I've got a question, but you've nailed it. You know, what would you say to adult adoptees, transracial adult adoptees who are listening into this podcast and are feeling that, you know, geez, I wish my mum and dad had known, or my mum's or my dad's had known what, had heard from Tony when I was growing up, because I'm struggling. I'm struggling at the moment. I'm struggling with who I am. I'm confused. I'm angry. I'm not in a good space. What would you say to them, Tony?
Well, one, I would say that I hear you and I'm here for you. And I understand, you know, it's difficult being an adoptee. It's difficult being an interracial adoptee who's an adult too. I would tell them that your life is no longer about what others want for you. It's about what you want for yourself. And part of figuring out what you want for yourself is figuring out the areas that you feel are strengths that you have. So tap into some of those strengths that you feel you have. If you feel that you're a good artist, get out of the house as much as you can and interact with, you know, an artist community. Interact in ways that are seeing you step outside of your own comfort zone. And also know that as adoptees, we really need to be careful about the people that we're, this goes for anyone too, that we're allowing into our social circles and that we're allowing to be close friends of ours. We want to have people in our lives who are open to learning more about what it means to be adopted, about what it means to be an interracial adoptee. We want people in our lives who won't consistently make problematic comments. We know that problematic comments may happen sometimes from those who don't know as much about adoption, but we want to feel as though we can address those problematic comments and that those individuals can change their behavior after learning more about adoption, and that it's okay for us to do that. And I do think that there is something to be said for reaching out to interracial with other interracial adoptees as adults, as adult interracial adoptees. That is an experience, just being in community with and talking to others, that is helpful. And I, as well as others, Isaac, I'm sure, would say the same thing. are resources for those who are feeling the pain of not being heard, who are feeling the pain of not being understood. So I would say, please feel free to reach out to myself, and also to look. There are Facebook groups now. There's a transracial adoptee group that is online that's filled with adult transracial, interracial adoptees for you to tap into there too. And to seek therapy. To seek therapy as well. Seek therapy of an adoption competent mental health professional, a therapist that understands the nuance of adoption and has worked with adoptees before. My organization that I work with, the Center for Adoption Support and Education, is an example of one organization that has a lot of adoption competent therapists too. So those are just some, you know, general suggestions. But
and you've forgotten to mention your book.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to put a link into the book. So tell us what the book's. I'm going to link into your your socials and a case in the show notes, listeners. So don't worry about trying to scribble that down. And I'm also going to link into Tony's book. So tell us about your book, Tony.
Thanks, Alan, for asking. So the name of my book is The Son with Two Moms. It's a book that's a memoir about my experience growing up with two white women who are different race from my own, and just the complexity of my own story. And, you know, our family went through a lot of stops and starts as it related to even being able to become a family. And I am the product of an open adoption. So I was also interacting with members of my birth family growing up. So I talk about what that was like. And I talk about moving into adulthood, what that experience was like too. And it was really just a great experience for me to be able to write about myself, because I realized that there were things that I hadn't processed yet about my adoption when I was writing my story. There were times when I realized that I was holding resentment inside for certain individuals or when I was writing the story, and then I needed to process those things in a healthy way. And writing was a way for me to do that. It was very cathartic. And it was a way for me to tap into, from what I hear from adoptees who have read my story, some similarities to their experiences and similarities to adoptees raised by queer parents, in addition to interracial adoptees too. So I had a lot of fun writing different parts of the story, and I am glad that I was able to put myself in that vulnerable position, as you're talking about, in that uncomfortable position of presenting a big part of who I was through the story and having others read it in that way. So thank you for asking.
Yeah. Are there any other good books on this topic?
Yes, so the book All You Can Ever Know by Nicole Chung is another memoir that's really good and talks about her experience as a Korean American interracial adoptee growing up with her family. Another good one is the Harris Narratives. Apologies if I butchered that name slightly. That book is by Susan Harris O'Connor and talks about her experience as a Black biracial interracial adoptee growing up as well, and is part memoir, part academic. And you know, I would just research online, you know, just type in adoption memoir, interracial adoptee memoirs. There are more than just a few out there. And again, our stories, you know, we're not a monolithic people. So it's good to understand the range of experiences that exist for us.
Yeah. So I've got a funny question for you now. Okay. Well, not funny, haha, right. A weird question for you. What's the question that I've not asked?
I don't feel like you asked what it's like growing up with queer parents.
Okay.
And I'll answer that myself. I feel like as a Black interracial adoptee, especially given the times that we're living in now, that's usually the focus of a conversation and what people want to hear and know about. But I can't talk about, I can, but to talk about that experience and not talk about what it was like being raised by white queer parents too is leaving out a huge part of my story, because they're intertwined. And they're intertwined for a lot of reasons. One reason is because as a Black individual growing up in the United States, a large percentage of Black Americans are Christian in this country. There are a large percentage of Christian, and I'm Christian myself as well, and there are a large percentage of Christians in this country who do not feel that being gay is completely okay, that it's sinful behavior. And white people and other races share this too, but being raised as a Black person by white gay parents, sometimes there's an undertone that I should understand that people are just, in my opinion, prejudiced in this way. And sometimes there have been instances where, you know, you want to connect with as many people as you can with, and you realize that that's difficult to do in situations where people are not accepting of all of your family. And I don't want to single out Black people and make it feel like only Black people are not in acceptance of gay parents or think that gay parents are going to hell. Of course not. You know, that's not the case. But I had an adoptee, an interracial adoptee recently. We were talking and she was just asking me about, you know, what it was like being an interracial adoptee in general. And I was telling her a story of someone one time saying, before I had the chance to say, when introducing me, that Tony's an interracial adoptee, a friend of mine saying this. And I was just saying that I felt kind of, and he's an interracial adoptee with gay parents is what this friend said. And I expressed to my friend that, to my interracial adoptee friend, that I felt kind of outed in that instance. And she said, that's interesting because I haven't felt, you know, just as an interracial adoptee, like I ever had to come out. I always felt like I, you know, this is my story, this is who I am, I'm an open book. And I was saying and thinking, well, that's how I feel too. But being an interracial adoptee in and of itself isn't necessarily a controversial statement to make, or rather, I should say, it's not as controversial is stating that you're an interracial adoptee adopted by gay parents. When you state that you're an interracial adoptee adopted by gay parents, you don't know if someone's going to say something that is extremely problematic that you now have to respond to, especially when you don't know someone and you don't know what their beliefs are in general. And so you have to be guarded about the individuals you're interacting with. And you also have to be on guard in realizing that there are going to be times when people make problematic comments about not only the racial aspects in regard to your life, but also about also in regard to the prejudice that is often just hurled at the LGBTQIA plus community too. And that I, as you know, as a heterosexual person, I feel like sometimes people are they might be more comfortable making problematic statements. They know that Tony's raised by two women and two lesbian women, but they also know that he's heterosexual. So maybe I can say something that is a bit problematic and he won't get offended by it. But I do sometimes get offended by it. I often get offended by statements that are made by individuals I'm interacting with. And it goes along with wanting to protect my family. And it goes along with feeling that while I'm not a direct member of that community, I'm an ally. In the same way that a white parent is hopefully an ally to the community of color that their child belongs to. So that's another, piece of my journey, of my story, that continues to come up as an adult too. And I expect that to continue. I was told, I was doing a book talk. This is when my book first came out, and a friend of mine put this huge placard of my book up for people to see it, so they could see it as they're walking up. And he was telling me that two women walked by and they saw the title of my book and they scoffed and they snickered, and then they continued to walk on to the next book. Now, I don't know, I didn't ask them, I wasn't there, why they snickered, right? But I have an idea. I have an idea, and I think that it was because the title of the book was The Son with Two Moms, and that there might have been some prejudice there that existed
For sure, yeah.
for that. Because on the book, it doesn't say on the title of the book that I'm an interracial adoptee, right? It says The Son with Two Moms. So that's the piece that I think stuck out. So that's why I think it's important to mention that part of my story too. And yeah, that's the only question that I can think of.
So that's great. I'm just conscious of time. Is there anything else that you'd just like to close with, Tony? Because we're just running to the hour here.
Like to close with, you can find my book on Amazon, The Son with Two Moms, but I'd also like to close with, learn as much about other adoptees' stories as you can. Go on Instagram, type in adoption, type in interracial adoptee, do the same thing with Facebook. There are so many interracial adoptees out there who are doing such good work and who are speaking truth to power, and who are integral parts of not only the adoptee community, but in my opinion, our society in general. And you need to learn, or you should want to learn more about us, and understand again that our stories are different, but have these underlying sentiments that are similar. So please learn as much about other interracial adoptees as you can.
Great. Thanks a lot, listeners, and we'll see you. And thank you, Tony. Sorry, I'm rushing. I'm rushing slightly, but thank you very much for your time, giving so much of your time today, and speaking so like precisely and eloquently about this. I think it's been an hour full of insights for me. So I'm sure it's helped the listeners too.
Thank you, Simon. Thanks for having me.
Take care. See you again soon, listeners.